Remember how to get to these? GraceBibleChurch.org. Okay? Don't Google it. It won't help. GraceBibleChurch.org. Okay. Now, we're studying in our efforts to learn a little bit from the life of David, some things about one of his predecessors, a guy that's going to have an influence on him pretty soon here, named Saul. And Saul was which king of the nation Israel was he? He was numero uno, wasn't he? Was he really the best guy God could pick, or was he kind of the chosen by popular demand, so to speak? Kind of the latter, wasn't it? Yeah, he was very attractive, humanly speaking. Tall, dark, handsome type of guy. He appears at the onset of our study of him to be a little bit on the reserve side. Remember, he was reluctant to take on the role that the people wanted him to take on, that of king. He kind of hid out amongst the baggage or the and hoped that maybe they wouldn't see him or something, I guess, at the coronation. But they found him and drug him out and put him on the job. And he kind of hit the ground running pretty good. He was their first anointed king, anointed by Samuel, God's spiritual leader of the nation at that time, and the last of the judges. And Saul's first duty on the job was to deal with this stink pot over on the east side of the Jordan named Nahash, and he tried to, in essence, take over this city up here of Jabesh-Gilead and kind of dominate that side of the Israeli territory. And Saul rounded up some folks and went up there and stomped on that guy, got rid of him, did a good job. And in the process, he gave the glory of the victory to God and displayed a number of kind of attractive qualities and characteristics. And we were sort of on Saul's team early on there, huh? We were thinking, well, this guy's doing good. They picked a good guy. But that didn't last too terribly long. For some reason, in the next conflict that we see him involved in, which was one with the Philistines, and nasty old Philistines were always around bothering the Israelis. And that one took place, look at the lower left corner here. In this particular incident, the Philistines are gathered in a place called Mishmash right here. And the Israelis are down here about 5 or 6 miles away. And they're sort of on a little standoff type deal. And Saul wasn't real sure what to do. He kind of seemed to be lacking a little bit in direction. And he was waiting for Samuel to get there and present the sacrifices, the pre-war sacrifices, before he was going to go on and do anything. So he's kind of just walking in place for a little bit. And Samuel was slow getting there. Didn't get there quite at the time that Saul thought he would. And so Saul says, well, I'm just going to take on Samuel's role of spiritual leader of the nation, and I'll offer the sacrifices. That go over real well? Didn't go over worth a flip, did it? No, that was a big mistake on Saul's part. And by the way, if I call him Paul, you'll know I'm talking about Saul. But that was a mistake. And God wasn't happy with that mistake. And in fact, Samuel told Saul that because of that mistake, he was going to lose his dynasty on the throne of Israel. He was not going to have a line of succession succeeding him as king of Israel. Now, he wasn't sort of thrown off the job right away, but he did lose that line of succession. So that was a big mistake there in chapter 13, his assuming the role of the spiritual leader of the nation when that was not his job and not his role. So our rosy picture of Saul that we had at the beginning of his kingship kind of got soiled somewhat by that decision on his part, and tiny bit inexplicatory, perhaps, but don't know exactly what to say about it. But anyway, he loses his dynasty at that point in time. So this conflict is not over as we go along here in chapter 14 this morning. The same thing is happening. The warring parties are still in the same place. Some of these maps are about all I got of them, so we just have to make the best we can of it. So the Philistines are up here kind of doing their thing, and Saul and his folks are down here, and they're trying to decide what to do and so on and so forth. And all of a sudden, Saul's son steps out of the shadows. His name is Jonathan. The day came that Jonathan, the son of Saul, in verse 1 of chapter 14, said to the young man who was carrying his armor, "Come and let us cross over to the Philistine garrison that's on yonder side." Now, Jonathan initiates this encounter along with his armor bearer. And apparently, both of these guys are young warriors, and they're good. They're capable. They're competent. And Jonathan says, "Let's go over there and whip up on those guys. What do you say?" And he didn't tell his dad, Saul. He did not tell his father. Why not? Jonathan, I think, probably has some insight into the character of his father that I think Jonathan probably thinks is just going to slow him down. It's going to get in his way. He doesn't want his father knowing about this encounter because he wants to step out by faith and go punch these guys in the nose real good. And he thinks his father will stop him. So he doesn't say anything. And Saul was staying in the outskirts of Gibeah under the pomegranate tree, which is in Migron, and the people who were with him were about 600 men. So Saul is kind of doing nothing. He's just sort of marching in place across the way there from the Philistines, and he's not doing anything. He's not sure what to do. Jonathan knows what to do. He's going to proceed. But Saul's kind of dragging his feet. And there was this guy named Ahijah, the son of Ahitub, otherwise known as Hot Tub. Ichabod's brother, the son of Phinehas, the son of Eli. Remember Eli and that storyline, what happened with him? He was the priest of the Lord at Shiloh, and he was wearing an ephod. So here's this priest who, in essence, is part of a doomed priesthood who is trying to serve what is part of a doomed kingship. So you got one loser, in effect, trying to help and minister to another one. So he's got an ephod. Now, why does that matter? Well, these priests that wore these ephods all had in those ephods two stones called a Urim and a Thummim. And they're never explained thoroughly in Scripture, but they were used to get an answer from God somehow. And apparently they were designed or made or built some way to get kind of a yes or no answer. I suppose you had two different things going on there, and you pull them out, and if both things line up, you get a yes, and if they don't line up, you get a no. But they have a way of being used to get an answer from God as to what to do. And so this priest has got those with him. And we'll see how they're used here in a little bit. But the people didn't know that Jonathan had gone. So he's gone on to encounter the Philistines, and Saul is sitting back doing nothing. And between the passes by which Jonathan sought to cross over to the Philistine garrison, there was a sharp crag on the one side and a sharp crag on the other side. And there's the names of them given, which I don't know a thing in the world about them. One crag rose on the north opposite Michmash, and the other crag on the south. So there's this valley between the two of them that's kind of enclosing. It's a little bit limiting in what you can do there, kind of a little canyon, perhaps, type arrangement. And Jonathan said to the young man who was carrying his armor, "Come, let us cross over to the garrison of these uncircumcised, Perhaps the Lord will work for us, for the Lord is not restrained to save by many or by few. So Jonathan says, look, let's go over there and encounter these guys, and perhaps God will work for us. He can save us by a whole bunch of people fighting, or he can save us by just you and me, a few. He's not limited in what he can do. So Jonathan has some insight and attitude toward God that his father apparently does not have. Jonathan's willing to step out by faith and encounter these guys, while Saul is still spinning his wheels, not knowing exactly what to do. And his armor bearer said to him, do all that is in your heart, turn yourself, and here I am with you according to your desire. That's a good soldier, isn't it? That is a dedicated soldier who says to Jonathan, hey, whatever you do, I do. You turn to the right, I turn to the right. You turn to the left, I turn to the left. You decide what you want to do, and I am with you. And these are probably young men. Young, good, loyal soldiers. Israel is blessed to have men like that in this, I don't know if you'd call it a standing army yet, it's kind of becoming one, but it's more like a militia maybe that Saul pulls together. But at any rate, these are good guys. So Jonathan said, behold, we'll cross over to the men and reveal ourselves to them. And we'll try to see if we can get a sign from God. And here's what we'll do. If they say to us when we appear to the garrison, wait until we come to you, then we will stand in our place and not go up to them. So they'll step out in the open, present themselves to the Philistines in the garrison, and if the Philistines say, stay where you are, we'll come to you, they'll stay right there. But if they say, come on up to us, then we'll go up, for the Lord has given them into our hands, and this will be the sign to us. So if the Philistines invite Jonathan and his armor bearer to come up to them at the garrison, they all know that God is with them and he's going to give them victory, and they're going to go up there and whip up on these guys. So that's their appeal for some indication from God as to what to do. And when both of them revealed themselves to the garrison of the Philistines said, behold, the Hebrews are coming out of the holes where they have hidden themselves. Remember now, a lot of Saul's army was deserting him, and they were hiding in the caves and anywhere they can. And so the Philistines think these two guys have kind of crawled out from under some rock somewhere where they've been hiding, and that's who they are, they think. So the men of the garrison hailed Jonathan and his armor bearer and said, come up to us and we'll tell you something. I used to use that same technique with my children. Come here and I'll tell you a secret. I didn't have no secret. These suckers fell for it every time. Well, that's what they've done, basically. Come up here and we got something we'll tell you. So Jonathan said to his armor bearer, come after me, for the Lord has given them into the hands of Israel. Jonathan knows what's going on here, and he is on the attack. So Jonathan climbed up on his hands and feet, and his armor bearer behind him, and they fell before Jonathan and his armor bearer, and they put some to death after him. And that first slaughter, which Jonathan and his armor bearer made, was about 20 men within about half a furrow in an acre of land. So Jonathan and his armor bearer do some serious booty kicking. They kill 20 of these guys, these Philistines, in a small, relatively small area, just a small portion of an acre. So the fight doesn't move very far because they're right there at the garrison and these two guys are cleaning up. Probably would have been a good move if Saul had said, I tell you what, Jonathan, you take over. I'm going to go sit down somewhere and let that guy handle things. They'd been better off. And the Philistines respond to that, verse 15, with trembling and scared to death, and the earth quaked, so it became a great trembling. The Philistines are shaken by what just happened to them. Two guys come up from Saul's army, his son and his armor bearer, and they whip up on 20 of these Philistines. So what's Saul do? How does he react to this? Well, Saul's watchmen in Gibeah and Benjamin looked, and behold, the multitude melted away, and they went here and there. His army is still deserting him. They're not nearly as loyal to him as Jonathan's armor bearer is to Jonathan. And Saul said to the people who were with him, "Number now and see who has gone from us." And when they numbered, behold, Jonathan and his armor bearer were not there. So they do kind of a quick census taking to see how many people they got to fight with. And in the process, they realize, hey, where's Jonathan and his guys? They're not here. So Saul, instead of doing much of anything, says to Ahijah, "Bring the Ark of God here." For the Ark of God was with the sons of Israel. So Saul's first move, his first tactical move in this conflict, is to try to get the Ark brought in. Remember, they're using that Ark kind of like a rabbit's foot, a good luck charm. And he doesn't want to move and do anything until he gets that Ark drawn up in their midst there. So it happened while Saul was talking to the priest that the commotion in the camp of the Philistines continued and increased. The chaos that is falling upon the Philistines is getting so great that Saul finally sees it and he says, "Oh, maybe I ought to do something here." So he tells this priest, "Forget the Urim and the Thummim here. Withdraw your hand. You don't need to pull that stuff out. I ain't got time to wait on you to get an answer. I got to go do something here." So, finally, Saul and all the people who were with him rallied and came to the battle that his son had kicked off in good fashion. And behold, every man's sword was against his fellow, and there was very great confusion. Philistines are starting to battle one another. Great confusion in the camp. And the Hebrews who were with the Philistines previously, these would be perhaps some traitors or some deserters, who went with them all around the camp, even they also turned to be with the Israelites who were with Saul and Jonathan. So a lot of these deserters kind of came back into the fight, joined back up with Saul and Jonathan. And all the men of Israel who had hidden themselves in the hill country of Ephraim heard that the Philistines had fled, and they also pursued them closely in the battle. So the Lord delivered Israel that day, and the battle spread beyond Beth-Aven. Now, when the battle finally is enjoined by Saul, and the people start coming back, we got our own resident ant in the machine or something there, it looks like, huh? Wow. Yeah, he's in the machine. At any rate, they finally get after him, and the Israelis are doing well. They're whipping up on him. And the battle is spreading, and more deserters are joining back with Saul and pursuing the Philistines, and they're whipping up well on them. Now, the men of Israel were hard-pressed on that day, for Saul had put the people under an oath, saying, "Cursed be the man who eats food before evening, and until I have avenged myself on my enemies, so none of the people tasted food." Now, this is hand-to-hand combat. And Saul, in his great military wisdom, forbids his army from eating anything that day. How in the world is that going to work out? That doesn't sound very smart, does it? And notice his reference or his thinking in all of this. "Until I have avenged myself on my enemies." Now, a guy that we saw early on was giving glory to God for his initial victory over there on the east side of the Jordan. All of a sudden now, it's selfie time. It's all about him. He is going to avenge himself on his enemies. Well, how about all the people that are fighting for him? This seems to be a bit of a change in his thinking and personality and what we saw earlier, wasn't it? This is foolish. He didn't show foolishness early on, but he's showing it now. He's showing reluctance to join the fight, which he didn't show that earlier on. He's showing foolishness in restricting his army to be able to fight. Well, my early vote for Saul, I wonder if I could get that vote back and rethink that a little bit, huh? I was all for him at first, but I'm starting to see some traits now that I'm not so sure I want to support myself. So the people are trying to run the Philistines down and finish them off, and they go through this forest, and there was some honey on the ground. And when the people entered the forest, behold, there was a flow of honey, but no man put his hand to his mouth, for the people feared the oath. People that knew the oath of not eating anything that day left that honey alone. They knew what Saul had said. But Jonathan, he had not heard when his father put the people under the oath. Therefore, he put out the end of the staff that was in his hand, and he dipped it in the honeycomb and put his hand to his mouth, and his eyes brightened. So Jonathan takes a little bite. He gets him a little bit of that honey down, and as soon as he does, man, he looks better. Physically, he kind of sparks back up a little bit because he needed to eat. So then the people answered and said, well, your father strictly put the people under an oath saying, cursed be the man who eats food today. And the people were weary. And Jonathan has the good insight and judgments to recognize that's not very smart. Verse 29 says, my father has troubled the land. See now how my eyes have brightened because I tasted a little bit of this honey. Look how much I perked up when I had just a little bit to eat. His curse on us has done nothing but hurt us. How much more if only the people had eaten freely today of the spoil of their enemies, which they found? For now the slaughter among the Philistines has not been great. He said, we barely are whipping up on these guys. If we'd been able to eat today and physically sustain ourselves, we could have wiped these guys out. But because of Saul's foolishness, they're struggling. They're laboring hard in this battle. So they struck the Philistines that day from Mishmash to Ajalon, and the people were very weary. Mishmash I can find on here. I don't know where some of these other places are. They can't be too far away. So at any rate, somewhere away from here, people are running them down and continuing to press the battle with them, but they're struggling because of this lack of the ability to eat anything. So the people rushed greedily upon the spoil and took sheep and oxen and calves and slew them on the ground, and the people ate them with the blood. So what they do is they do resort to livestock that they've captured, but they don't have a facility set up to, in essence, drain the blood from these animals before they eat them. And that was forbidden for Israel. They were never supposed to eat meat with the blood. Always were to drain the blood from animals before they ate them. Well, they're just eating on the fly here, anything they can. The people are violating that fundamental rule. Then they told Saul, saying, behold, the people are sinning against the Lord by eating with blood. And he said, you have acted treacherously. Roll a great stone to me today. Well, Saul uses rule number one from the loser's handbook, and that is blame somebody else for your screw-up. That's rule number one. That's the one Adam and Eve used, wasn't it? Adam said, hey, it was Eve's fault that I sinned. Eve said, it was the serpent's fault that I sinned. Somebody other than me is responsible for this mess. And that's essentially what Saul does. He caused the problem with his own foolish obsession with ritual. So he said, trying to blame it on somebody else, though. And Saul said, well, disperse yourselves among the people and say to them, each one of you, bring me his ox or his sheep and slaughter it here and eat. Do not sin against the Lord by eating with the blood. So he changes his rule now and says, look, bring your animal here. Do it right. We'll set up an altar and you can process this animal properly and eat properly. And so do that. So all the people that night brought each one his ox with him and slaughtered it there. Saul built an altar to the Lord, and it was the first altar that he built to the Lord. So in realizing what he'd done and how foolish it was, he does in turn tell the people, well, let's do it right. Go get your animal and we'll process this stuff properly. So Saul says after that, well, let's go down after the Philistines by night and take spoil among them until morning light, and let us not leave a man of them. So Saul says now, let's go get them. We're going to wipe these guys out overnight. And the people said, well, whatever you say, boss, do what seems good to you. So the priest said, let us draw near to God here. And Saul inquired of God, shall I go down after the Philistines? Will you give them into the hand of Israel? So he seeks an answer from God, probably using the Urim and the Thummim, these two stones that were in the ephod or the breast thingy of the priest. But God did not answer him on that day. He didn't get an answer from the priest. Well, that's not good. That's what the priest is there for. That's what the Urim and the Thummim were there for, is to get answers from God. So Saul says, draw near here, all you chiefs of the people, and investigate and see how this sin has happened today. That is, Saul concludes that the answer that did not come back from God was because of sin in the camp there. Who sinned, Saul says? Good grief. For as the Lord lives, who delivers Israel, though it is in Jonathan, my son, he shall surely die. But no, not one of the people answered him. So Saul says, look, we're going to find out who did this. And if it was anybody in our camp, even if it was my son, he'll have to pay. Now, he doesn't probably think it was his son. That isn't why he said that. He's just trying to use an extreme example and say that nobody's going to escape this thing. Even my son is not going to escape this. But that too is foolishness. He doesn't know that his son might be one who has sinned here. Then he said to all Israel, you shall be on one side, and I and Jonathan, my son, will be on the other side. And the people said to Saul, do what seems good to you. So they separated the camp between Saul and Jonathan and the rest of them, and they're going to draw lots and see where the sinner is. On which side of this divide are the sinners? Therefore Saul said to the Lord, the God of Israel, give a perfect lot, and Jonathan and Saul were taken, but the people escaped. The lot fell on Saul and Jonathan. That is, one of the sinners is right there between you two guys. It didn't come from the people. And Saul said, well, cast lots between me and Jonathan, my son. And Jonathan was taken. So now they select between Saul and Jonathan who the sinner is, and the lot falls on Jonathan. So all of a sudden now, the process of pursuing the sinner has come up with the answer, it was Jonathan. So Saul says to Jonathan, verse 43, tell me, what have you done? So Jonathan told him, and he said, I indeed tasted a little honey with the end of the staff that was in my hand. Here I am, I must die. Jonathan admits that what he had done. And look at Saul's reaction, verse 44. May God do this to me and more also, for you shall surely die, Jonathan. Well, that's a nice remorseful reaction, isn't it? This guy is becoming predictably foolish. He doesn't even mind that his own son, who started this conflict in a positive way and got it rolling so that Israel could have victory, that he is the one now who is supposed to suffer death. What's happening to this guy? this doesn't seem to be quite the guy we saw earlier, does it? Focusing upon himself throughout the battle, now showing no remorse that his son is going to have to die as a result of this. Now, this is not the same man we saw earlier. And I don't know that I have a good explanation for what the change is. What has prompted that change? This is the best soldier he's got. This is his son. And it doesn't seem to matter because he made an oath and Jonathan is the victim of that, and so Jonathan must die. Thank God there's still some people that have their heads screwed on. They say in verse 45, must Jonathan die, who has brought about this great deliverance in Israel? Far from it. As the Lord lives, there shall not one hair of his head fall to the ground, for he has worked with God this day. So the people rescued Jonathan, and he did not die. The people are showing some sense. Saul is not. Saul is behaving extremely foolishly. He seems to be obsessed with these superstitious rituals that he's relying on and not using his head at all. And the people recognize the foolishness of that decision and they step up and say, no, you're not going to kill Jonathan. He's the only reason we got the victory here today. So Saul went up from pursuing the Philistines and the Philistines went to their own place. So he didn't go after them like he said he was going to do. He just let them disperse and go away. He broke off the battle and didn't actually complete it because of the foolish decisions and so on that he had made. So, first battle over there on the east side went well. Saul performed very well, and we were impressed with him. When we saw him take this city back up here that was being pressed by this guy over on this side. But the second battle against the Philistines, did not go. There's only like four choices in it. I think I flipped this thing six or seven times and I still don't have it right. This second battle against the Philistines, right in this area somewhere, did not go nearly so well. In the first battle, we didn't see the kind of foolish behavior on Saul's part that we see here at the second battle. Now, we know he's already lost his dynasty, but he hasn't lost his job. He's still the king. He's just not going to have a line of succession following him, but he still is king. But we're seeing quite a bit different personality here than we saw before, are we not? Something has changed in this guy, and he's not nearly as impressive as he was earlier. I want my vote back. I want to reconsider my earlier vote. I was happy and willing to give it to him after that battle over there on the east side, but I don't think so now. I don't like what I'm seeing here. So the chapter concludes with a summary of Saul's career. Verse 47, when Saul had taken the kingdom over Israel, he fought against all his enemies on every side, against Moab, the sons of Ammon, Edom, the kings of Zobah and the Philistines, and wherever he turned, he inflicted punishment. He acted valiantly and defeated the Amalekites and delivered Israel from the hands of those who plundered them. That sounds pretty good, doesn't it? As I mentioned to you before, Saul's one of the biggest tragedies I think we see in the Old Testament era, his life, because he does have positive characteristics and traits and things to offer. This copy didn't turn out very well, so I just drew around it with a line here. This is all the territory that Saul had conquered during his his kingship there. That ain't too shabby, is it? The guy was a valiant warrior. He fought hard for Israel and conquered all of that territory, whipping up on his enemies and the enemies of Israel as he went. The ones down there to the southeast, Moab and Edom, the Amalekites to the south, the Ammonites over on the east side, the Philistines. You'd wish this guy had been a little more successful, don't you? This guy presents some very attractive, positive qualities that you would like to support. But unfortunately, he's got some negative ones that we'll see even further as we go along that results in his destructive behavior. But that's the brief summary. I just stuck in there just to kind of maybe summarize what he's been doing or had done. And then there's some of his genealogy given there. The sons of Saul were Jonathan and some other people. We'll see more of them, some of them later. Verse 50, the name of Saul's wife was Ahinoam and the daughter of Ahimaaz. And the name of the captain of his army was Abner. That's a name you might want to remember. This is the son of Saul's uncle. That would be his cousin. Abner is the son of, is the cousin of Saul. Now, later on, Abner and David will have a bunch of dealings together. So just remember, Abner is Saul's cousin. That's about all you need to know about the guy from now. But he will be the head of Saul's army. Now, the war against the Philistines was severe all the days of Saul, and when Saul saw any mighty man or any valiant man, he attached him to his staff. So Saul continues to fight the Philistines throughout his entire kingship, and anybody that he runs across that he thinks is a good soldier, a good warrior, he conscripts them into his army. Now that will probably be one of the reasons we see David joining with him later, is that Saul will recognize a quality there that he wants in his army. So that process has begun. Now, Saul's building up his army with the best soldiers and people like that he can find. So, first battle went well. Second battle didn't go so well. Saul shows characteristics and traits early on that somehow or another seem to get away from him, and he starts to show some traits that are problematic. He's lost his dynasty as a result of him assuming that role of spiritual leader in the start of this second battle that is not his to assume. So that much is already gone. But the kingdom, the job, is still his. It's still there for him to lose, and we'll see how that goes as we go on. Now, as we get ready to enter into chapter 15, there's a couple of items of background information that we need to remind ourselves of. After God brought the children of Israel out of Exodus, out of Egypt via the Exodus, he established an operating principle with them that would govern them from that point on throughout their history. It would be about 400 or 500 years before this. And this principle is oftentimes referred to as the Deuteronomy theology. It's a very simple principle. Let me read it to you. Chapter 28 of Deuteronomy. Now it shall be, if you will diligently obey the Lord your God, being careful to do all his commandments, this is Moses talking, which I command you today, the Lord your God will set you high above all the nations of the earth, and then all these blessings will be yours. That part of the theology says obedience brings blessings. In verse 15 of Deuteronomy 28, but if it comes about that you will not obey the law your God and the Lord your God and observe to do all his commandments, than his statutes with which I charge you today, that all these curses will come upon you. Second part of the theology is disobedience brings judgment. So the operating principle between God and his people from the time of the Exodus on down through the rest of the Old Testament era is that obedience trumps everything. Obedience brings blessing and disobedience brings judgment. This principle is not a list for how to cherry pick what you want to do or not do. It says you must obey all of God's commandments. So Saul grew up under this principle, and he should have known that obedience is the most important aspect to the relationship between God and his people, and it trumps all other possible actions. Obedience is job one for everybody in the nation Israel. Okay? He should know that. Remember that. The second principle that we need to remind ourselves of as we begin chapter 15 is a principle called, it's sometimes translated the ban, B-A-N. It's dedicating something totally to God for complete destruction. Now, it's a principle that we have a little trouble grasping in Western society because it basically involves the total wiping out of certain peoples and their assets and everything having to do with that. God told Israel that he was going to totally wipe out the Amalekites. He says in Exodus 17, 14, he says, I will completely blot out the name of Amalek from under heaven because they had resisted and fought Israel. So he was going to blot this people out from off the face of the earth, devoting them to destruction. The ban. It's actually, if you transliterate the Hebrew, it's harem, H-E-R-E-M. That's the Hebrew word for this practice of totally destroying or wiping out something. That was a known aspect that it existed under the operating principle that we just talked about, the Deuteronomy theology. And it did require a divine mandate. That is, God had to tell the people to do that. They couldn't just decide to do that themselves. But it was indeed a mandate that he did use at times. He tells, for example, in Deuteronomy chapter 20, 17 through 18, he says, completely destroy them, the Hittites, the Amorites, the Canaanites, the Perizzites, Hivites, and Jebusites, as the Lord your God has commanded you. Otherwise, they will teach you to follow the detestable things that they do in worshiping their gods, and you will sin against the Lord your God. The purpose for the ban is to prevent his people, his children, Israel, from sinning against him. By wiping out the source of that sin and not embracing those peoples and their practices and their gods. Because he knew that if they did not do that, if they did not wipe them out, they would embrace those peoples and their practices and their gods. They'd intermarry with their women, and they would start worshiping their gods. So the purpose for the ban, or the harem, H-E-R-E-M, was to prevent his children, God's children, Israel, from sinning against him. Okay? See the practice? Yeah, and it requires a divine mandate. God had to tell them to do this. They couldn't just go out and decide to do it if they wanted to. So there's two fundamental overriding principles of life with which Saul should have been familiar as we enter chapter 15. The Deuteronomy theology, obedience trumps everything and brings about blessings. Disobedience will bring about judgment. That's number one. Number two is the ban. Total destruction of someone to prevent his children from sinning. Okay. Well, let's go ahead on into 15. We got a little bit of time left. We'll go ahead and talk about a little bit of this. Okay, with those two aspects to life before God in mind, Samuel says to Saul, "The Lord sent me to anoint you as king over his people Israel. Now, therefore, listen to the words of the Lord." This is a divine instruction to you from God. "Thus says the Lord of the hosts, I will punish Amalek for what he did to Israel. Now, he has set himself against him on the way while he was coming up from Egypt." That is, this guy and his people fought Israel. Exodus chapter 17 gives you the story behind this, when they were coming up out of the Exodus. "So now, go and strike Amalek and utterly destroy all that he has, and do not spare him, but put to death both man, woman, child, infant, ox, sheep, camel, and donkey." The ban. So God has told Saul to go implement the ban against these Amalekites. And notice what's to be left of them. Nothing. There to be a smoldering pile of ash. Man, woman, child, animals, everything. That's the assignment that Saul has. So Saul summoned the people and numbered them in Telaim, 200,000 foot soldiers and 10,000 men of Judah. And Saul came to the city of Amalek and set an ambush in the valley. And Saul said to the Kenites — these would be a certain ethnic group of people that were living amongst them — "Go depart, go down from among the Amalekites, lest I destroy you with them. For you showed kindness to all the sons of Israel when they came up from Egypt. So the Kenites departed from among the Amalekites." So this tribe of Kenites were spared. Saul goes and tells them, "You were kind to us when we came up out of Egypt 400 years ago. So you guys and your descendants get out of here and you'll be spared." And they did. So Saul defeated the Amalekites from Havilah as you go to Shur, which is east of Egypt. So all the way from the north to the south, everywhere there, Saul wiped them out. Let's see, I think that one map might have showed some of them on there, didn't it? Got it on the machine already. Okay, see, they're down here. So it's these people down here now that he has been sent down to wipe out. And he was told by God to do that. So he defeated them, and verse 7, all the way down there toward nearly all down to Egypt. And he captured Agag, the king of the Amalekites, alive, and utterly destroyed all the people with the edge of the sword. But Saul and the people spared Agag and the best of the sheep and oxen, the fatlings and lambs and all that was good, and they were not willing to destroy them utterly, but everything despised and worthless they utterly destroyed. Does anybody see a problem with this? Two principles are in play here. Obedience trumps everything, and the ban, which God has divinely initiated in this particular instance for Saul, required the complete and total destruction of everything and everyone. Did he do that? That probably isn't good. He has violated both of those fundamental operating principles that we just summarized. The Deuteronomy theology, obedience trumps everything, and the concept of the harem or ban of not sparing anything or anyone under divine direction. Well, I wonder what the consequences of that's going to be. Well, come back next Thursday and we'll figure it out.
You know, some places God would tell them to destroy everything, and they wouldn't. They would keep stuff back.
What about that?
Well, God would tell them to destroy everything.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yes, this concept of the ban required a divine directive. They couldn't just decide themselves, well, we're going to go in and fight this battle and we're going to wipe out everybody. God has to tell them to do that. Then they were under the obligation of what God told them to do. So it wasn't willy-nilly. It wasn't something that the human warriors or leaders could implement. It required God's direction to do that. Okay? We'll see the consequences of this next time. Now, Saul has lost his dynasty already, but he hasn't lost the job quite yet of being the king. And we'll see what happens as a result of what he's done here. Because what he's done is violate both the Deuteronomy theology and the ban. And we'll get into it next time. We'll see what the consequences of that are. Any questions or comments? Yeah, Peggy.
It was a sin that Saul said they couldn't eat just because he had the power to declare that?
Say that again. I didn't quite hear that.
How come it was a sin, declared a sin, when Saul just said his warriors couldn't eat and Jonathan ate? How come that made it a sin just because Saul said it was? As a king, when he made the oath?
No, they ate the meat without draining the blood. That was the sin of the people. What's that?
But he ate the honey. Well, that was just
That part I don't think we necessarily have to label Jonathan as the sinner there. Saul sinned with his foolishness that he was doing, and the people sinned in eating the meat. Jonathan probably wasn't guilty of anything. He was the least guilty of anybody in the whole story.
So did Jonathan eat the meat with the blood too?
No, apparently not. So he was actually innocent. He was just unfortunately the victim of Saul's foolish vow. And that's what makes it even more disappointing about Saul, is that he tried to withstand that foolishness instead of simply realizing, you know, he's the one that made the mistake. So Jonathan is getting, in effect, accused and punished for something that really wasn't his fault or really wasn't a sin. Saul was the foolish one there. Any other questions or comments? Okay, we'll let you roll, and we will see you next Thursday, Lord willing. Grab those cone parking spaces. Don't ever leave any of them open.
Okay.
I beg your pardon? No, the mishmash stuff was all down around Benjamin in this area here.
I see.
This eastern battle was up here, and a lot of it is here. And this latest one is down here. The Amalekites.
Yeah.
They were down south there. So when Saul went down there, he was to wipe them out. The Philistines, he tried, but they managed to hang in there and battle him most of the time.